Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Sorry you missed the show last week. We had a football game in the way, but we're in the clear for this week, and I am very excited about the program that we have today. I think you're going to hear a lot of things that you've never heard before. In fact, you'll hear my guest today say that segregation may have saved his life in the military, and that he also appreciated how the military was integrated before the rest of our society was here in the United States. An interesting dichotomy that we'll discuss today with Walter Smith, who's been living in the Valley for the last 40 years, originally from Philadelphia. And I guess that's where you were probably on December 7th, 1941. I start off with so many of the veterans on this program on that date. What do you remember about that day, and how long did it take for the news to get from Honolulu to Pennsylvania?
Well, at that time I was a teenager, of course, and I think a football game was on the radio, and I think it was interrupted, and the news came over and so forth, and of course I was excited like everybody else. I hadn't been following the news that closely, and I didn't know that we were ready to go to war or anything of that nature. But at the time, I got with some of my other teenage friends, and we said, well, hey, we want to go. I guess that was our youth talking and so forth. But we decided we would we wanted to go on our own terms. So we heard that in the meantime, we heard that the Canadians weren't as segregated as our forces were, and that there was a good chance that we could get into the air branch in the Canadian Air Force. So we made a dash up there, but things didn't turn out like we thought, and so that was the end of that.
So you were so eager to get a piece of this that you and your friends drove from Pennsylvania up across the border.
Oh yeah, we got up there, and but it didn't work out the way we thought it was going to work out. There were so many qualifications and things of that nature, and I guess we just didn't fit the qualifications. So we came back and waited for the draft. In the meantime, that didn't take very long, and
And let me ask you this, growing up there in Pennsylvania, when we think about segregation, we think primarily of the South.
Right.
Being in Pennsylvania, in the northern United States, did you run into much prejudice? Was that a part of your everyday life, or was it kind of foreign to you?
No, I think it was common in a way that it wasn't brought out directly. Indirectly, I mean, you always felt that you were being treated as an inferior. And in the school system, it was the same way. I mean, it seems like we were all packed into the same schools and so forth. It was possible to break away from that, because I think I did. I left high school, when I left junior high school and was going to go to high school, all of us that were black went to a predominantly black school.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was determined that I was going to get a better education if I didn't go to a school like that, because it was considered inferior in a way. And so you could always, in those days, you could register for a school. You had to go do it personally, I think it was, or your parents had to do it. And so I was registered in a school that was predominantly white. In fact, I think the whole time I was in that particular high school, I very seldom ever saw another black student in my class except at recess and lunch period.
Were you able to play sports or anything for the school?
Yes. We were considered pretty good at track and field. And at football, they were trying to place us in football, but that was a pretty rough situation because all the boys on the team were predominantly white, and we were supposed to be pretty fast. And they would try us out in a position that they used to call scat back.
Right.
And that means you got the ball and you ran like hell. And of course, most of those boys on our team were quite a few of them were Polish and big, heavy guys, and they would try to kill you, even though you were on the team, on their team. So
I'm laughing. I'm sure it was no laughing matter at the time for you.
No laughing matter at the time, but some of the guys managed to. Let's see, I think one of the fellas managed to make a varsity on our team. I got hurt the very first season, so I never made the varsity. So
there was an awareness on your part that in many ways the deck was kind of stacked against you.
Oh, yes, yes. But in track, we were pretty fast. The joke was that in our ghetto neighborhoods, we always had to run for our lives, and maybe that was true in a certain extent, because the gangs had developed at that time, mm-hmm. and if you didn't belong to a certain neighborhood and belong to that gang, and you were out of your neighborhood, you better run if they spotted you or anything like that. So that's when we got in the habit of running across traffic and running between cars and all that sort of thing. So they knew we were fast, so they always tried us out for the track team, and we usually made it.
Well, let me ask you this. It just occurs to me now, obviously, when you talked about hearing about Pearl Harbor and wanting a piece of the action, I imagine you wanted a piece of the action in Europe. And I'm wondering if the Olympic Games, of course, in Berlin had been 5 years before that with mm-hmm. Jesse Owens and his 4 gold medals and, of course, the snub
right.
by Adolf Hitler. Was that something that resonated within the black community at that time?
Yes, it did. It really did, yeah. And we figured that things were much better over there. And, in fact, our entertainers did pretty well in Paris and so forth, in France. And we were all aware of that. And let's see, I think it was Josephine Baker at that time that was mm-hmm. a big name. And we figured it was a worthwhile fight to get into.
And so that's what you had in mind. But once you finally got drafted, it didn't turn out to be what you expected it to be. Right?
No, we were in segregated outfits, of course, and on segregated bases, too. And I remember most of the bases, we had a certain area that we were restricted to. And if you wanted to go to, headquarters was in a what we call a white area. And if you wanted to go into headquarters, you had to get permission and so forth. And it was just an odd thing. I mean, it was hard to get used to. And besides, don't forget, in those days, everything, the water fountains and the things like that had signs, and you only could use the ones designated for colored. And
did you ever run into a situation where you tested those rules or were yelled at for breaking those rules?
When you got out into the civilian population, off base.
Give our listeners a picture of some of these bases. I know one of them was in Georgia, which is about as far south as you can go, and that is the stereotype, of course. But was it a recognizable difference for you, having been from Pennsylvania and then being in some of these bases in the south, to see that you were treated differently or worse?
Yeah, it was, because when I first went in, I got by training up in Massachusetts, and there still was that stigma. And when you went off base, I mean, because, you know, soldiers always like to go to bars and have a drink and relax and all that, that sort of thing. But then we found out that that some of these bars and so forth didn't want to cater to you. And that's where I got in a typical fight. And I guess that's where I got my first wound. I got stabbed in a fight when we, I think the three or four of us went into a bar, and they didn't want to treat us right or serve us appropriately.
Is this a situation where you're in uniform or out of uniform?
Oh, in uniform.
In uniform.
In uniform.
And there's a war going on.
Yeah.
And they know who you're working for.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that's the sort of thing, but it wasn't as bad in the North as in the South. In the South, they let you know directly that, hey, you're not on a par with any of us.
Now, I don't want to press you too hard here, but you just talked about this fight where you got stabbed. That sounds a little scary to me. Is this a situation where you feared for your life? What happened? Did someone, was it the owners that confronted you? Or?
It was a, no, some of the patrons in the bar, some of the guys who, I mean, they weren't service personnel, they were civilians, but they were pretty near, I guess, pretty near our age. We were, the group I was with, the three of us, we were all teenagers, three or four, and I think those guys were, they hadn't been drafted yet or anything like that, so they were a little older. But they didn't appreciate us coming to their bar and so forth. So that was the name of the game, I mean, pretty much everywhere. So
So did you have to go back to the base to find a doctor, or what did you do?
No, it wasn't that bad. I mean, so I got stabbed, I bled a little and all that sort of thing. I think I got, I was taken care of, but... I mean, it was nothing that would put me out of commission or anything.
Probably your pride and your dignity were wounded even more than your flesh, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, because we lost the fight.
That too. I'll tell you what, we're at a place where we need to take a quick commercial break, but we're going to come back with more of the fascinating story of Walter Smith. We're going to find out why he says segregation actually saved his life. And, you know, a lot of you often ask me, if I'm ever going to interview Korean War veterans or Vietnam War veterans, well, guess what? I am today. Walter Smith is a veteran of World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War in three very different roles. He's going to tell us all about that, hopefully, if we have time in the program today. So we'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty. On 580 KMJ.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a vocal style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. Came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
That's the Andrews Sisters from many years ago, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, one of the songs that Walter Smith remembers from his time in the service. Something tells me you never blew that bugle as the reveille boy, huh?
Oh, of course not. But some way or another, we sort of related to that, at least the guys that I was with and everything. It was an uplifting song, really. And... you had to take everything with a grain of salt when you were in the military, and because the military is not a democratic force, so that helped quite a bit.
Now, you were telling us before the break about some of the discrimination that you were faced with as a young soldier in the U.S. Army during World War II. Whether you had a uniform on or not, more people were more concerned with the color of your skin. And the thing that just that I feel inside of me is I can't imagine having that much self-control to put up with some of this stuff and not just go crazy. How did you deal with that ever-present reality without just going ballistic on people?
Well, I think there's always a degree of hope that's involved with the African-Americans in this country. And it goes back to the church, too, I think. Lots of us were raised in the church, and we believe that things would get better. And really, they did gradually. But it was a slow process.
Well, and you can speak to that because you stayed in the military until 1969, and we're going to hear more about that. Now, the first outfit that you ended up with, as many black soldiers did in World War II, was what was called an engineer regiment. But it seemed like the duties that you were given, I don't know, you wouldn't say necessarily beneath you, but certainly not what you signed up for.
We thought we were going to be fighters. I mean, that was the thing. I guess that's a macho attitude. And you find out that you're using the shovel and the axe and the pick and all that sort of thing and doing really, just ground digging work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and a lot of KP.
Yeah.
Now, so, you're officers, so your unit is exclusively black, except for the officers, who were predominantly white.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you told me that you can't prove it, but many of you were convinced one of your officers had been in the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. And it wasn't a fact that he tried to hide or anything like that. But I know when we moved to an area where we were doing some work, and there was a lake nearby, and of course, the area was predominantly white. I mean, we figured on our off time, we'd go to the lake and swim. And he forbid us to do that. I mean, the population had nothing to do with that. This was an order from him.
And, just being spiteful.
Yeah. So things like that, you know. Of course, we couldn't go to the lake and swim in the lake that belonged to white people. And so forth.
I imagine that there was a lot of commiserating, or at least you guys would share your stories and your experiences. How much did it help to be in that with other people who were going through the same thing? How much did you draw on each other for strength in a situation that had to be frustrating?
Well, I think a lot of it. We understood what was going on, and I remember, I mean, some guys were very dissatisfied, and one guy decided to desert,
mm-hmm.
and we all knew about it. So when something like that happened, he didn't come back from leave, and so they would investigate, talk to the people in the outfit, and wanted to know where he had gone and what was his thoughts and all that sort of thing. And you just played neutral, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Didn't want to rat him out.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that was his way of dealing with the situation.
What kept you going? What kept you motivated to serve your country when some of your fellow citizens aren't treating you the way that you wanted to be treated?
Because there was always, we always knew that there were people who wanted to help us and do better. I mean, even during slavery time, I mean, the Quakers and so forth and units like that backed us up and helped with the Underground Railroad, as they called it, and so forth. And so we knew that there was always hope.
Mm-hmm.
Things would get better. Things were gradually getting better in certain places. So that's the thing that kept us going.
And you decided at some point you would feel a lot more fulfilled and have a lot more excitement if you got out of that unit that you were in. How did you accomplish that?
Well, at the time, it depended on the president's wife. And so Mrs. Roosevelt was pushing to have black troops in combat outfits. And, of course, she succeeded, and that started with the some of the outfits, like the, I think it was the 99th, and a couple of black regiments, and, of course, the Japanese regiment.
Before 42nd, so forth, yeah.
And, but there were just a few, but at least that was showing that there was hope and everything.
Integration was starting to begin.
Integration was starting. And it was a fight because lots of people objected to it.
So you, how did you hear about this paratroop unit and decide that that was something you wanted to volunteer for?
Well, because the word came down that they were going to let blacks be in the paratroopers and so forth. And so it wasn't just something that they would just announce and say, here, we want you to volunteer. It seemed to be sort of a word that was passed down through the network or something. And once you heard about it, I mean, I went into headquarters and wanted to put in my application and so forth. And, of course, it worked out.
So you ended up with the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion,
yeah,
otherwise known as the Triple Nickels.
Right.
And you went through the same training at
yeah,
Fort Benning.
Yeah, I went through the same training.
That all the white paratroopers made.
Right.
You hear a lot of times about the 82nd Airborne or the 101st Airborne,
right,
and what they did on D-Day.
Right.
And this is what you thought you would be doing.
Yeah, because we were a part of those units, but we weren't because we were attached, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when they decided that they were going to go across, they didn't want to take us.
So they were heading to Europe to get ready,
right,
for Operation Overlord and this massive invasion in June of 1944. And what happened to you guys? And how frustrating was it that you weren't going with
That's
them?
That's right. It was very frustrating. And then we found out that we would be assigned to the West Coast Command here as in the West Coast Defense Force, and that meant that they used us for smoke jumping, firefighting, and so forth.
You are the smoke jumpers, the original,
yeah,
smoke jumpers, and you hear that, and people think, well, why in the world would you parachute into a forest fire? What are you doing in that situation?
Well, it wasn't so much going into the fire. I mean, you parachute into the area.
Right. You know, to fight the fire.
To fight the fire.
But I'm sure that wasn't what you had trained for in Georgia.
Oh, no. No, we hadn't trained for that.
Did you have to have new training?
We had a little bit of training on that and so forth. I mean, I don't know how extensive it was. I didn't feel that it was, well, maybe it was the best at that time. I mean, I'm trying to compare it with what you see today,
mm-hmm,
and it was nothing like that.
But it seems to me that it must have been an emotional roller coaster for you, because here you're frustrated in the unit you're in, you think you're getting into something a little more exciting and fulfilling with the paratroopers, and then right as everyone's about to ship out, you get sent to the other side of the country, nowhere near where all the fighting's going
That's
on.
That's right.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I guess not too well. I mean, most of us were a little bit discouraged about that, but that was the name of the game, so we played along with it.
Had not much choice, I guess, at that point.
That's right.
We're going to take another break, but when we come back, we're going to find out more about what smoke jumping was all about and what the top secret aspect of this duty for the Triple Nickels, the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, was. We're going to hear what Walter Smith did for the duration of World War II and why he decided to continue in the military, serving for the next quarter century in the Air Force from that point on. Walter Smith is our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with you on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at KMJNow.com. Fascinating conversation today with Walter Smith, who experienced the segregation in the U.S. military during World War II, also experienced the integration of the U.S. military through the following quarter century. When we left off, he was talking about smoke jumping in the Pacific Northwest. His paratroop battalion was sent to the Northwest to fight fires. There wasn't a whole lot of information that the public got at this time, but one of the things I've read was that the Japanese actually had hydrogen-filled balloons that were unmanned, but equipped with the right mechanisms to know when to release a sandbag to go up higher that could make it all the way to the West Coast and then drop these incendiary bombs in U.S. forests. I had never heard of that before I read up on the smoke jumpers. Now, you don't know how many of the fires you fought were caused by those bombs or not, but tell us a little bit about what these smoke jumps were like, and did you feel like you were in danger as you're dropping out of this airplane to a smoke-filled forest?
Oh, no. I mean, we knew we were near the fires and so forth. I mean, it was just like one of the fires we went to was up in Montana, I think it was. After we jumped there, they took us to the camping area where the firefighters were supposed to congregate and then go to the fire. And it was amazing because the town seemed so small that you could look and see from one end of the town to the other. And on top of that, you could look from the town and just see lots of open space and then the forest and everything. It was just completely different from, I mean, having basically lived on the East Coast and raised on the East Coast and everything, that you had so much space and everything and so many trees and so many fires and all that sort of thing.
And they had to drop you in by parachute just because of how remote these locations were?
Yeah, mostly because it was remote, yeah.
How many guys would you go in with? I mean, it sounds like it might be pretty lonely work for a while.
No, our entire unit would go. Of course, your headquarters unit didn't participate as far as I can remember. But we would get together with other firefighters, people that did that sort of work, and we all went in together.
So you, as this military unit, are partnering with civilian firefighters?
Yeah.
Wildlife ever become an issue for you? Run into any bison or anything there in Montana?
No, I don't remember. I mean, the fire and the smoke, that was our worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't think about snakes and things like that. Although, I mean, running animals and so forth, I mean, they did pose a problem, but that was the major problem.
Probably coming from a big city on the East Coast, it was kind of nice to see all of that nature, as you talked about.
Right.
How long did this go on for? Were you doing this until the end of the war? Or?
Yeah, until the end of the war. We decided to, most of us decided to get out.
Were you off in a firefighting situation when you heard that the war was over?
Yeah, our unit was, yeah. But what happened was that everybody was leaving the service at that time because, after all, the war was over, and you had a choice. I left the service, the active duty service, and was on the...
You were in the reserves?
In the reserves.
But the GI Bill gave you the money to go to college?
GI Bill, I decided to go to college on that. And there were some of us who did that. And that's where I ended up at Hampton University. You could choose any school you wanted to. I had tried several schools, but at the time it... it just wasn't my thing. Because I tried up in Massachusetts, and I just didn't feel at home with the setup there. Then I moved down to another school, Howard University at that time,
mm-hmm.
and that was predominantly a black school, a black college, and the students there were showing up in suits and ties and all that sort of thing, and here I was military and used to not dressing that way, and we were sort of, some of us were treated as outsiders and coming into a cultural situation. So I didn't feel at home there, so I left there. And all this was during the very first weeks of registration and so forth. So then when I got to Hampton, proper registration was over in a way, and I didn't have proper papers. But I was, since I was GI, I got in on probation. And, of course, everything worked out from then on.
Well, and that's where you met your wife. So I think someone had that plan for you to end up at Hampton.
I hope so.
And you're convinced that none of this would have happened. And I want to get to this because you made a statement to me that segregation saved your life. The segregated military saved your life. And I guess you're convinced that you wouldn't have been there at Hampton to meet your wife or anything since then if the government hadn't sent the white paratroopers over to Europe and sent the black paratroopers to the West Coast. When did you make that realization? And explain that for our listeners, if you can, why you say that segregation saved your life.
Well, we had to have some kind of a joke to cover up our the insult and so forth. And, of course, you always do that sort of thing. Put something funny in. That's the way you survive, you know. And we said, The white paratroopers went over and caught hell on the initial assault and everything, and we weren't there, so we didn't catch hell. So we said that was the point, that probably that segregation saved our lives.
Well, and it, like you say, it is a good laugh line, but there's some pretty solid truth to it, too, because as you mentioned, the significant casualties that those paratroopers suffered over there, that easily could have been you if you were there.
That's right.
And so segregation saved your life in that sense in the military. But then after you get your degrees and you have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, you end up back in the Air Force during the Korean
conflict.
No,
I didn't have my master's at that time.
Not yet. Now you have it. You have it now. And he's 85 years old, and you can tell he's still sharp as a tack and still going strong. But I'll tell you what, I want to take a break here. But when we come back, I want to hear about how not only some of the rest of the things you did in your military career and what you've done since, but how you saw the way that you were treated
mm-hmm.
and people like you were treated from World War II till when you retired in 1969 from the military and how much progression was actually made. So we're going to get that from Walter Smith when we come back. That'll be the home stretch of Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've got about 10 minutes left in the program. The time always goes by too fast, and today is no exception. I am inspired sitting with Walter Smith today and just trying to soak up some of his stories, some of what he went through, and I think the best is yet to come if you're listening at home. So we're going to move on now. He was out of World War II. You heard him tell about his experiences in the U.S. Army, a segregated army during World War II. It's a country where we declare that all men are created equal, but he was not treated equally. And after the war, that's something that you couldn't help but think about. And you stayed in the reserves, so you know there's a chance of another war. There's a chance Uncle Sam can call you back. And you had a little, I won't say you had a conversation with yourself, but you told yourself something. You made a determination of what you would and wouldn't do. Tell me what that was.
I said I would never fight in a segregated outfit, and that was it.
It just hurt you as a person so much.
Right.
And so here along, just 5 years after World War II, here comes the Korean conflict, You're recalled. What's the Army doing with you?
Well, the transition was taking place, but transition in any force is slow.
Mm-hmm. And by transition, you mean President Truman had declared the Army will be integrated.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And our unit had not reached that stage yet. So we had orders to go overseas.
With an artillery unit.
With an artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still going to be segregated. And so I decided, no, I'd promised myself I'd never do that. So I put in for my resignation. And the only way I could do this, having being in the military service, was that I could not go resign with my rank. I have to go into another service.
Now, I don't want to slow you down here. To me, it sounds like this took a whole lot of courage for you to do what you did. Is that something that you deliberated over and said, I don't know if I really want to say this, because once I say this, there's no turning back. But what did it take for you to go and say, I won't do this?
It took a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of soul searching and so forth, because some of the other officers in our black unit, I mean, thought that was ridiculous to give up a lieutenancy.
You were at the time a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
And they told you, if you want to do this, you can go to the Air Force, but you're not a second lieutenant anymore. What? How much rank would you have to give up?
All of it.
All of it.
So I'd go in as an airman.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did. And, of course, I mean, when they realized that I was had been an officer before, I could put in for an officer or a training school.
Right. But I imagine this is not just your pride and your rank. That's probably a pretty big cut in pay, too, isn't it?
Oh,
to go
yeah.
from a second lieutenant to an airman?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But it meant that much to you.
Right.
To not serve in a segregated unit.
Right.
I think all of our listeners applaud you for that principle that you showed. So take me from there. How did things progress once you got into the Air Force?
Well, after I made officer in the Air Force and everything, I was became a navigator out of the training school and everything. And my first assignment was the old B-29s, which we were still using.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I went over to Korea, flying in the old B-29s.
And you were, I'm pretty sure that almost every one of your missions, you were probably the only black soldier on those flights, right, among that bomber crew?
On my bomber crew, yes.
How were you treated?
I was treated pretty good, mm-hmm. I thought. And it all depends on the aircraft commander.
Sure.
And at that particular time, I had an aircraft commander who was very liberal and so forth in his beliefs and things like that. And also we had on the B-29s, you also had enlisted personnel.
Sure.
And I think it was a crew of nine, if I remember correctly. And we had, I was the black officer, and we had one black enlisted man or airman. And it worked out pretty well. In the training program, they wanted to be sure. And I tell people this because people still don't know this, that they weren't sure that black officers could fit in. And they put psychologists, we used to call them squirrel doctors, and they put them in different outfits to monitor how well we operated and so forth. We were still being tested.
Mm-hmm.
And in the training program, the whole crew was involved. And we went through a program in which we pretended like we were shot down and all that sort of thing, and what we would do as a crew and so forth to recover and get to our lines and that sort of thing. And that's where the squirrel doctor was still with us, and he evaluated every one of us, supposedly. And it turned out that our crew came out pretty good. No problems except with one of the enlisted men, one of the airmen, who couldn't get used to the fact that there was a black officer. And so he was taken off our crew.
He was taken off your crew.
He was taken off our crew.
What a far cry from what you experienced in World War II.
Yeah.
Could you feel a difference there? Did that make you feel better about what you were doing and just where the country was by seeing that they were backing you up instead of taking his
side?
Oh,
yes, definitely. There's plenty of progress. And, of course, I mean, that solidified my love for the Air Force, believe me.
Mm-hmm. And I spent so much time talking about how you were being treated and some of the things you were doing, but now you're actually getting to do what you wanted to do. You are
right.
In combat. You're flying bombing missions. Was that exciting for you? What did you enjoy most about it?
Well, it was exciting, but then philosophically, I began to think about the fact that you were killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And that began to get to me in a way. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the glory and fighting and the macho attitude and all that sort of thing. But then when you get right down to it, you're killing your fellow man.
Yep.
And, of course, I begin to feel that. But that becomes a necessity in a way. And I guess the only way you get by that is to say that you think your country has done everything it could to not be in this situation. But once you're in this situation, this was the only thing that you could really do.
Well, and you're doing your job. You're following right. Orders. And I've always been fascinated by how someone deals with that very human side of war, and everyone agrees, war is hell. That's
right.
One of the most apt quotes of all time, I think, and you certainly experienced that in World War II, in Korea, and even in Vietnam, where I understand you were on the refueling planes, right, KC-135?
Yeah, KC-135s, and the combat missions I flew there, what they did to, we were attached to a different outfit, a different unit, the Air Tactical Command, and we would play Mother Hen, as we used to call it. We were a refueling ship, and we would either have anywhere from 3 or 4 fighters that we would take over the combat area, and they would go down and do their bombing and do their shooting and so forth, and then they would come back up.
So you'd just be circling higher up.
We'd be circling in the combat area and so forth, and we would refuel them and so that they could complete their missions and so forth.
Were you ever fired upon?
No. We were... Intelligence showed us or told us where the areas were that there was heavy flak or something like that. The enemy didn't have that much, but sometimes they were pretty accurate. But
so you had the intelligence that steered you clear
right.
From that. Well, we're down to about the last minute of the show here, and I know there are so many more stories from your decades in the military that you'd like to share. One thing I'm curious about, when you retired from the Air Force in 1969, what was your rank?
I'd made major.
Major. Yeah. Did you ever think how much higher you could have been had you stayed in the Army, or do you think that the ceiling in the Army would have kept you down?
No, I could have risen higher because some of the fellows that didn't have my particular philosophy stayed with the Army, and most of them retired as colonels.
Mm-hmm.
So,
something tells me you wouldn't have it any other way than it went, though.
No.
Well, and my hat is off to you. I'm sorry that we're out of time today because I think everyone listening is feeling the same way I am, that hats off to you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the moral and personal fortitude to do what you have done and to be here to talk about it today. Is there any final thought that you want to share with our audience about why you served our country for so long?
Well, because I believed in what the country was fighting for at the time. And I believe we maybe he couldn't have, we couldn't have done worse. And we were doing what we thought we was right at that particular time. And in the meantime, I take my hat off to the military, because I love the military, really. It wasn't as bad as some people say it was. Most people complained about the food and all that sort of thing. I thought the food was great. I thought the training, when we got training, was great. The only thing you had to really contend with was the fact that it was not a democratic force. It was a military force.
And you learned that lesson full well, for sure. You've shared those stories. Again, thank you so much for sharing those stories with us today, for serving our country, and for making us proud. That's Walter Smith, our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.